This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Help wanted. Major American financial institution. Great compensation package. Excellent benefits. Chalice only slightly poisoned. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Tuesday, today the 11th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So here is an interesting employment conundrum. The fourth largest bank in this country, Wells Fargo by name, can't seem to find anybody who wants to run it. The top job has been open for more than 2 months, ever since former CEO Tim Sloan resigned in March, the second Wells CEO to leave in less than 3 years. And the Wall Street Journal reported this morning the top candidates have dropped out of the hunt because sometimes a plum job might not be, as Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports.
A lot of us would probably take the $15+ million salary that the CEO of Wells Fargo will likely draw. But Alex Thompson at executive search firm Odgers Bernstein says most of us probably aren't right for the job.
I mean, there are only a few people who can run a 260,000 employee, you know, 70 million customer worldwide bank. So finding that person right from the get-go is not easy.
Those people are already making a lot of money in other jobs that don't have the headaches that Wells does. Regulators have cracked down after employees created fake accounts and charged unnecessary fees. The past two CEOs have resigned after facing scathing questions from Congress. This isn't your typical executive search, according to Robin Farricone at compensation consultancy Ferriant Advisors.
I think they do have to offer premium.
And if that doesn't work to attract a CEO with a proven track record, Wells Fargo is going to need to turn to the second string.
It's somebody who may be one level below that, but has shown tremendous capability in terms of leading an organization and executing change.
And there, troubled companies may find plenty of potential candidates, says Thompson at Odgers Bernstein.
For some people, that's the challenge. Because if you do create shareholder value and end up as a success, you know, you really have branded your career in a really positive way.
The downside of picking a second stringer is that it's a big risk for a company that's already in trouble. Wells Fargo declined to comment for this story. I'm Ben Bradford from Marketplace.
We pause now for some tariff news, political tariff news, to be clear. Mick Mulvaney, the acting chief of staff to the president of the United States, at a panel in Washington today, you're going to hear Eamon Javers from CNBC asking the question.
Does the outcome of the Mexico negotiations, which the president says is a huge success, and there's a secret part to it that we don't know about, does that embolden the president in terms of dealing with the Chinese and Xi Jinping? A lot of people are looking ahead to Osaka and the G20 and trying to figure out whether we're going to get a deal there. Does Mexico make the president more likely to take a hard line with Xi or more likely to cut a deal?
I think that's a really good question. So let me make news then, I guess. I think it probably emboldens him to take a tougher stance.
Honestly, it was a pretty obvious question, right? The G20 in Osaka, Japan, 28th of June. That'll be your next trade war update. You know, or know of, anyway, the Billboard charts, right? The industry marker for what records or, yes, streams are the most popular. Well, Billboard has disqualified some of DJ Khaled's most recent album sales that were tied to the promotion of energy drinks, bundling it's called. Sometimes it's a concert ticket, sometimes it's a keychain or an energy drink, but sales get inflated when that's done, as does an artist's ranking in the charts. Marketplace's Eric Barris has more on those bundling deals and how the charts are drawn in this age of streaming.
The Billboard charts, which track top artists, hot songs, best-selling albums, used to be pretty straightforward. Ted Paczynski is a music professor at Indiana State University.
It was so simple back when we simply counted success or gauged success by how many albums were, quote, sold. Physical product made it so much easier. But boy, with digital delivery,
It's a bit more complicated. Now the charts use a formula that includes those physical album sales and on-demand plays from places like Spotify and Apple Music and program plays from apps like Pandora and Slacker Radio. Different types of plays are weighed in the formula differently. And to make it more complicated, bundling has become part of the equation. Musicology. It started in 2004 when Prince bundled ticket sales for his Musicology tour with downloads of the album. But now, says Imran Farooqi, who teaches entertainment law at Syracuse University,
now downloads can be bundled with a whole lot more products because all you need is a code.
In 2012, Taylor Swift partnered with Papa John's Pizza to sell her album with a large pie. Jay-Z had a similar deal with Samsung Galaxy phones. These sorts of bundles have become standard among top artists.
It really is sort of, you know, a cheaper version of PR and marketing.
But then it can skew the charts and make a band or artist seem more popular than they are. Billboard says it is reviewing its rules regarding how it counts albums bundled with merchandise. Jeff Mayfield, a former Billboard chart director, says it raises the question.
Does this really reflect the consumer's want?
DJ Khaled!
As for DJ Khaled, even though some of his record sales may have been disqualified, he's still hanging near the top of the Billboard 200 chart. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Might as well have stayed home for all the difference today's session made in the major indices. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. For all the attention that STEM education gets in this economy, a report not too long ago from the consulting firm Deloitte showed that we are going to be millions of people short in filling the 3.5 million science, technology, engineering, and math job openings we are going to have in manufacturing alone in this country by the year 2025. The government knows that, and it's putting money into programs meant to get more young students into the STEM pipeline. According to the National Science Foundation, funding from just one single source has reached more than 1 million K-12 students. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the rest of that one from KUT in Austin, Texas.
These sophomore biology students at Austin High School are studying how epidemics work. The kids are huddled around laptops running different scenarios, like how vaccination rates affect the progression of a disease. Anthony Petrosino is an education professor at the University of Texas at Austin. He's in charge of the National Science Foundation grant that's paying for these kids to learn this stuff.
It basically allows students to program and to use the computer to create things. They become active participants and creators and designers.
Getting students engaged in STEM fields is important to U.S. employers. Many feel forced to bring in foreign workers through complicated and expensive H-1B visas right now. Maya Denton is doing her part to get more students interested in science and tech. She's a graduate student in STEM education at UT Austin. Her federally funded research focuses on preparing K-12 teachers to improve math and science education by broadening the definition of STEM.
All of the science and engineering and math involved in things like sewing or crafting or things like that, all of the things which may not get counted as it, but actually involve a lot of principles in STEM.
Getting more minority students enrolled in college STEM programs is the focus of Sarah Eichhorn's federally funded work at UT Austin. Under her new initiative, 25 low-income sophomores will get $5,000 each to do math and science research.
Wealthier students have the opportunity to volunteer and do research, whereas low-income students have to work and don't often have the chance to do extensive undergraduate research.
All three of these STEM initiatives have something really interesting in common. The foreign workers we told you about, the ones who are here in the U.S. to perform those STEM jobs, are basically paying for the programs that would render them redundant. Stuart Anderson is director of the National Foundation for American Policy.
One of the best-kept secrets in immigration policy is that every time a company uses an H-1B visa to hire a foreign national, a good chunk of money goes to fund training and scholarships for Americans.
A typical employer pays about $5,000 to apply for a worker under that H-1B visa program. 30% of that goes to training and scholarships. That's more than $5 billion since H-1Bs hit the scene in 1998. A lot of money, but immigration attorney Sandra Feiss says the government is curiously silent about what these fees are doing.
politicians like to use H-1Bs as this rhetorical punching bag, saying that they're taking Americans' jobs. But they, you know, never talk about the fact that every time an H-1B is filed, that money is directly funding training for American workers in those exact fields where we have so many H-1B workers.
Even many of the researchers and academics who are funded through these H-1B fees are in the dark. Sarah Eichhorn at UT Austin.
I had no idea that this money was at all tied with visa fees.
Not until I told her, anyway. In its 2020 budget, the Trump administration suggested boosting H-1B fees. That could discourage smaller employers from applying to get those workers. But the Department of Labor says the goal is to raise even more money for scholarships and to train Americans in STEM fields. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
A few steps down the employment ladder from the top job at Wells Fargo, the tight labor market is doing a number on retailers trying to attract and retain workers. Target has a newly expanded family leave and child care policy. Walmart's got new tuition benefits and free SAT prep classes to snag high schoolers. But a lot of retailers and service businesses aren't offering something a lot of workers say they want, a consistent and dependable schedule. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
Jamise Davis is worn out from her job at a cosmetics store in Columbus, Georgia.
I worked from 6 until midnight, and then I had to get back up the next morning at 7 in the morning to come in.
As an 8-year veteran of the retail business, she's become reluctantly accustomed to crazy hours, sometimes late nights, sometimes early mornings, often scheduled with less than a week's notice.
I actually have mental health issues. I haven't been eating properly. It affects me greatly.
Davis is not alone in her schedule struggles. A survey of thousands of hourly workers by the HR app Branch showed schedule stability was the second most important job factor after only higher wages. Here's Branch CEO Atif Siddiqui.
About 80% of employees experience some degree of pay variance week to week.
That makes budgeting tough and affects people's health and relationships, according to Susan Lambert at the University of Chicago.
For parents, it can make it very difficult to establish family routines that are important for child development.
Lambert says one of the reasons why the restaurant and retail industries have been slow to change scheduling practices is the need to respond to changes in customer demand. One exception is Walmart, which rolled out a predictive scheduling program last year. Using an app, workers can schedule up to 90% of their hours 13 weeks in advance. Spokeswoman Michelle Malisok says analyzing the immense traffic in their stores allows them to better predict their staffing needs.
We can only do that because of the size and the amount of data that we have.
Many local governments are starting to step in where industry hasn't. The state of Oregon and the cities of New York, San Francisco, and Philadelphia have all passed laws forcing businesses to offer guaranteed hours and advance notice of schedules, with several more cities looking to follow suit. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up,
you can't really make a living as a freelance food writer. It's very, very difficult.
Working in the digital food industry is anything but a piece of cake. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 14 today, less than a 10%, 26,048. The NASDAQ flat, 78.22 there. The S&P 500 less than 0.1% to the downside, 28.85. CVS shares took a hit after news that a federal judge might rule against the company's $69 billion acquisition of Aetna. Shares of CVS tracked down about 2% today. Another deal that might be hitting a roadblock, that $26 billion merger of Sprint and T-Mobile. A coalition of state attorneys general are suing to block the deal. Shares of Sprint tumbled 5.8% today. T-Mobile shares down 1.5%. Bond prices, they fell. The yield on the 10-year treasury note rose to 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace. You know, Marketplace is a source you trust for information about the economy and how it affects our lives. We're also a nonprofit news organization, and we are counting on listeners like you to support this kind of journalism. Any donation helps, but if you give $30 right now, it'll be matched dollar for dollar by another one of our generous supporters, the Candida Fund. Please become a Marketplace investor today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We just got back the latest numbers from our Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll, tracking how you are feeling about this economy. We've got all those results, by the way, at marketplace.org. But polls and headline numbers are one thing. People's stories of their economies are another. And that gets us to this latest installment of our series, My Economy.
I'm Anna Taylor from Atlanta, Georgia, the owner and operator of Taylor Properties. I started this year with just the goal of getting one property. If I can get one under my belt, I would feel like I would be doing well. I'm the first person to ever own a home in my immediate family. And so it was just like a full circle moment to be able to purchase a property. So I was ecstatic, and it was a fire lit underneath me to where I was like, oh, you know, this wasn't that difficult. I can do this again. And that's how I began to purchase homes at a great rate and then be able to offer them at an affordable price. I still grapple with the fact that some of the great deals that I'm able to take advantage of right now is because someone else can't keep their home or it's been foreclosed on. It's a sad situation. My mom passed away when I was younger, and for a short period of time, I actually lived in my car as I was getting ready to go to school. And so being homeless and being in that predicament, I think I'm more empathetic to those just looking for an opportunity to find something they can afford that's safe and looks nice. And a lot of times when I get calls from people, they are like, oh my gosh, this is such a great price. Or, oh my gosh, this is the only thing I've been able to find in my price range because of, you know, landlords jacking up the rent. And so I don't want to be one of those people. In my mind, I'm thinking, I want to make a reasonable profit. Yes, I want to be able to save away, and this is my nest egg. This is my retirement. But at the same time, I don't want to hurt people on my way up. The great thing about being the first to do things is that you get to make the mistakes and then pass on the information and educate others. Especially for my daughter, she calls herself my vice president, and she's only 8. But it's important for her to see mommy in this role. And I hope in a few years, collectively, our family can come together and have our own business where we get the apartment buildings and we are able to buy a property where my uncles grew up in Miami and Liberty City, you know, in the areas where people call it undesirable, because that's where we come from.
Anna Taylor. There she does real estate in Atlanta. Wherever you are or whatever you do, this series only happens because of you. So please share your story with us at marketplace.org. How many times have you looked up a recipe online or watched a cooking video or liked a food post on Instagram? Most of you, probably at least a couple of times. Some of you, lots. Some of the most popular blogs and YouTube channels and Facebook pages out there serve food content to millions and millions of eyeballs. Back in the early 2000s, though, a whole wave of digital startups was just starting to see the potential for food online, which is just about the time that Ed Levine, then a best-selling food guide writer, started a website called Serious Eats. It made a splash at the time, and it is still a thing, but not the big, big thing that Ed Levine hoped it would be. And that is the story of his book about his adventures in food and trying to run a digital media business. It's called Serious Eater. Ed, welcome to the program.
It's great to be here, Kai.
You had, before you happened on Serious Eats, you had a varied career, we should say. You were sort of...
There's one euphemism.
Well, yeah, right? had it been 2019-ish, we'd have called it the gig economy. But you were in music, you were in advertising, you were doing everything. How did you come to Serious Eats?
Well, I came to Serious Eats because I was a successful freelance food writer, and that all depends on your definition of success. I was getting good paying assignments from The Times and GQ and Gourmet, but as we all know, and it's still as true now, you can't really make a living as a freelance food writer.
It's very, very difficult. And I got to the point where I was like, you know, I'm really tired of gatekeepers. I'm really tired of constantly selling my ideas and myself. And so Serious Eats was sort of a bid for creative and financial freedom.
Okay, so here's why that's interesting, right? That bit you just said about tired of selling, in essence. You start this thing that is built around your passion of food and getting people to good food and writing about it. And the reason we wanted to have you on to talk about this book is your passion becomes a business that you have to hustle and work for that takes away from your missionary zeal. Is that fair?
Yes. Yes, I would say you've just hit upon the crux of the problem, as it turned out, in 2006. We were all intoxicated by the seemingly unlimited possibilities of the blogosphere.
Yeah.
And I was one of them. I fell prey to that. And, you know, it's like, yeah, we're going to tear down the walls. We're going to control the means of distribution. And how hard could that be? And then it's like, oh, it's actually really, really hard.
To quote you back to yourself, you say, I never went more than a month without having to raise capital.
It was insane, Kai. And I just had no idea what I was getting myself into. Everyone wants a business that will scale. When they say scale, they're talking about, can you get to a place where you can sell it and people will get 10 times their money, right? That's what VCs want. Mm-hmm. They don't want singles. They don't want bunt singles. I think Serious Eats was maybe a bunt single.
So just so everybody's clear, a bunt single to a VC is barely making back their investment, the 1X return, right?
Yeah. Exactly. It's the 1X return, and VCs don't have no interest in that. And I just think post-financial crisis, I was really asking people for money so that I could have my dream job. Huh. But I just could never say that.
That's a good line. So I'm gonna not give away how this book goes, but let me just say you do eventually wind up getting it sold. Your investors recover most of their investment. There's a fairly gripping passage of the stress levels that you were dealing with trying to run this business. What I want to ask you, though, is do you miss running the enterprise?
I am actually still running the enterprise, but
not the way
I'm
used
running
it, right?
No.
Yeah.
I don't miss, Kai. I don't miss. Am I good for payroll? I hated that. Man, that was just like a ball and chain that I couldn't wait to get rid of.
A word here about food media today. I wonder if you weren't maybe like 7 years too early with Serious Eats, because food media today, man, I mean, it's everywhere. It's a big deal.
It's everywhere, and yet if you really draw back the curtain, high-quality content is not worth what it used to be. I'm not sure. Here's the other thing about food media and startups. I used to depend on the Times and Condé Nast never figuring it out. Okay? Really, I would tell people that. It was like, well, are you worried about the New York Times in the 2006? I was like,
nah,
nope.
Yeah.
Well, guess what, Kai?
Yeah.
They figured it out.
You got to pay for the cooking.
And they're really good
now,
at
right?
it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
For sure.
And it's great. And, you know, Condé Nast with Bon App, they figured it out. Because what did they have? They had time and they had resources.
They had resources, right? They had the backstop,
right?
For sure, yeah.
Yeah. And so when your business is operating in a really dynamic environment that's changing at the speed of light and you don't have the resources that will give you the time, you're kind of screwed. And you know this better than anyone. You don't hear these stories. You hear the stories of the unicorns and the stories of the great flameouts.
Right.
And when we know that 99.99% of all businesses fall in the middle, and Serious Eats fell in the middle. It was so I could have my dream job. I just didn't know all the baggage that would come along with the dream job.
Ed Levine. It's a book called Serious Eater. He is the founder of Serious Eats. It's a good read. It's as much food, really, as it is running this business. Ed, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me, Kai.
So I mentioned Ed had had a varied career. Part of it was in the music business, so he made a playlist to go along with his book. You can check it out at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, the United States women's national soccer team started its defense of its World Cup title this afternoon. Spoiler alert coming, I guess, for those who taped it. Take a minute, turn it down. All right, here you go. 13-0 over Thailand. Yes, 13. But that is not the important part. The important part is that there is, as you may know, a lawsuit currently pending filed by the members of the women's team alleging pay discrimination. According to the complaint, all other things being equal, women's national team members make a maximum of $4,950 a game. Men, they average more than $13,000 a game. And oh, by the way, the women's team has won the doggone World Cup 3 times, people. All right, we got to go. Just flat all over the place on Wall Street. Today, our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Stephen Bion, Danielle Chiriguayo, Joanne Griffith, Annika Houston, Ben Hethcote, and Sarah Menendez. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.